Hi, it's Paul Bayes with GreatDad.com, and I'm here with my weekly conversation with dads and taking a look at modern fatherhood. And I got a little bit of a different spin because usually we talk to a lot more of a younger dad audience because a lot of this content is for dads who are really in the prime of, you know, parenting. But today I've got Al Lyman, who's, I don't know how to describe you, Al, but you are a like a polymath, a generalist in terms of longevity and healthy aging. So I welcome Al.
Paul, thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I think you're going to have a really interesting perspective, both for some of the older people, older men who might be in our audience, as well as the younger men looking forward to how they want to manage their life long term. And then these older dads who are, you know, like thinking now about, you know, their older years and how they want to live them and what they should do to make sure that they live them out in good shape.
Right. That's the idea. You know, it's interesting. When you were introducing me, the first thing I thought of in terms of describing myself is I'm a dad.
Good.
And my kids who are now, my daughter, Erin, is now 37. My son, AJ, is 31. They both moved on, you know, they have families and careers. And interestingly, as a side note, in my book, which I know we'll talk about, I talk a lot about my own father who passed, unfortunately, 22 years ago from brain cancer. And I've got this tattoo, which if your audience is listening, they won't be able to see, but it says hashtag make them proud or make him proud, excuse me. So a lot of what I've learned over the course of my life has really been about watching my parents and how they aged and how their health evolved. And of course, watching my dad suffer and die from brain cancer was probably the hardest thing I've ever experienced. But a lot of what drives me today is waking up, I think, and just doing whatever I can do to make my dad proud of me, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a driver for any of your fathers living out there is, you know, what can they do in their own life to make their kids proud of them?
Yeah.
And also their parents,
yeah.
You know, perhaps their father or their mom, because taking care of yourself, honoring your health, doing all you can to protect your health so you don't become a burden to those people, unwillingly, by the way,
we don't set
out with the intention to become a burden, but it happens inevitably if our health fails. So in truth, living for the betterment of our health, honoring our health is one way, I think, to make our dads and our kids proud of us.
Yeah, well, that's quite a testament to your relationship with your father that you would put that tattoo on your arm. And I would wish for all of our audience that we'd be that great a dad that someday we would do that. The interesting thing about your perspective is that you are not a doctor. You are not a nutritionist. You're not a lot of specific things. So you do have, you're certified in a lot of different disciplines, but what you take is kind of a more holistic approach, looking at all kinds of different factors in aging without being stuck in one lane, like nutrition's the only way or that sports is the only way or whatever the thing is. So talk a little bit about how you got to the point, how you developed that kind of attitude where you were going to learn all these different disciplines at once, because I know you have a philosophy of how you want things to end eventually. And I'm sure that tied into it.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. You know, it's interesting. When I was a kid, I wasn't athletic. I didn't do sports. I was always the last kid to get picked on.
Oh, me too. No shame in that.
When I got my first job out of college, a lot of my colleagues were, you know, working out. And so I thought I should try to get in shape. And so I started a running program and it was really hard. I was really bad at it. And of course, you know, struggled with this idea of just coming to grips with how out of shape I was. But as time went on, I got a little bit better. And then over time, as my fitness started to improve, I started to become sort of into that lifestyle, that running lifestyle. And I started to become more aware of my overall health. And along with that, the health of people that were around me. So at 25, when someone asked me off the cuff why I ran, and this was a person who hated running, I think they expected me to say something about my races. But in truth, what I said to them was, I run to square the curve. And it's something I had been thinking about for a very long time. Now, square the curve means visually, I had this graphic, which I ended up scratching down on a piece of paper, but I saw my life evolving as a horizontal line where I wasn't sick I wasn't struggling with dysfunction. I was feeling good. And then one day, far off into the future, at like 110 or 120, I'd go to sleep one night and not wake up. And that was the vertical line.
Yeah, that's what we all hope, right?
Right. And that was juxtaposed against what we see now, which is much more common, which is a slow, gradual decline of health over time. You know, think of it as a gradual downward sloping curve. In my book, I say that many of us, unfortunately, die a slow death before our actual demise, be it emotional, cognitive, or functional. So I had this vision of not experiencing this decline at 25, and it became the driver for me. And every day since then, I thought about what it would take to create that good health, to give myself the best chance to die healthy. And of course, at 25, you know, I was just being aware what, you know, I think was probably the biggest part of it, watching my parents struggle with their health and age at what I thought was a very rapid rate, watching their friends. And of course, in the years since, we've seen chronic disease even accelerate to a much greater degree. Things like prediabetes or metabolic dysfunction, you know, these kinds of things have just gotten worse over time. In the US, 1,700 people a day die from cancer. Heart disease continues to be the number one killer. And I think modern medical science is, in some respects, keeping us alive longer. Right. But to me, it isn't about the length of the years. It's about the quality of the years. It's that health span, which is really the quality of our life, versus lifespan or longevity, which is really just the number of years. So I think about these two things very differently, because I don't think anyone in your audience, if given the choice, would want to live to 110 if that meant that the last 30 years of their life that they were suffering, right? That they were in constant pain, or that they were dealing with, you know, constant doctor's visits and constant hospitalizations and constant convalescence. Nobody wants to live the end of their life that way, but that's what we see a lot of. So over the course of my life, while my primary background is really fitness and exercise and all of that kind of thing that kind of emanated out of the running, one thing I noticed was how all of these aspects, whether it be our mission and purpose, a reason for getting up in the morning, the food we eat, when we eat it, how much we eat, right? Mm-hmm. The types of food, the movement we get, certainly the sleep and the stress we experience, good and bad, and so many other things all contribute to what I like to say as increasing our areas of opportunity, right? Giving ourselves a better chance to have the kind of ending that we would like to have, right? Which is to be able to be there. I mean, I have this vision, this dream of not just being here for my great grandchildren's birth, but being able to participate. Maybe even be at their wedding, maybe, you know, be at the birth of their children. I mean, it seems like a pipe dream in a way when we think about it, but I think it's possible with a little good fortune. The challenge is for all of us, you and me and every other person listening, is believing that our choices matter enough to begin to take control of our health. That's the key, because I think many people are just apathetic. They go, hey, it's my family history, right? It's like my dad had this, my, you know, whatever. One of the things I share in my book is a picture of my dad at 59, 4 years younger than I am now. And he looks 85. And there's a picture of my great-grandfather who passed at 72 in a convalescent home. And he's nothing but skin and bones. And he himself looks like he's in his 80s or 90s. So to me, these are clear messages that, at least in my instance, DNA hasn't determined my destiny, right? It's a factor among many, but it isn't what actually dictates how our life flows out from the standpoint of our health. But we need to believe that, and then we need to start to learn and take action and start to make changes so that we can really give ourselves the best opportunity. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people get sick. It's a great mystery in many respects. There's a lot we don't know, but Paul, there's a lot we do know. That's what I think we have to act on.
Right. So I don't want to spend too much time talking about the younger people, because I think there's probably enough in the media about all the different categories. But I think your advice probably to the younger guys, 25, 30, 35, would be to start thinking about this and start realizing that you have to make changes, better to make changes early on, to not suffer that maybe, you know, 30, 40 years, like you say, in a wheelchair and a kind of less known, because when you get to closer to our age, that becomes not just just a concept, but you've learned from your parents, watching your parents and their friends age in that way. And it's not a fun thing to see. Well, moving on to older men, because I also work with dads 55 plus dealing with empty nesting and finding meaning later on in life. Sure. What would be the top things that you would suggest to an older guy in that cohort that they should start doing if they haven't started doing now yet?
Well, I think, you know, always at the top of every list, and we can talk about, you know, mission and purpose and all of these other things, which become really important. We've got to have a reason to get up in the morning.
Yeah, that is, and so fundamentally attached. If you don't find meaning and really work at finding meaning, a lot of the exercise and everything that you do is not going to matter as much if you don't have that purpose.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a chapter in my book on blue zones, and one of the things we can learn from, you know, the Okinawans or the folks that live on the island of Sardinia. The blue zones, as you may know, are the regions of the world. There are 7 or 8 of them where there are more centenarians than in any other location on the planet. And we can really learn a lot about how these people live. And the Okinawans have a word, ikigai, to describe.
Oh, yeah, ikigai, yeah.
Right. And so I think it's fascinating, you know, to look at those things. But back to your question, because I want to stay on topic just like you do, right? We could talk about this for hours, trust me. At the top of any list, when I talk to folks, especially in that 55 and older age group, what's the most important thing? To me, first and foremost, it starts with resistance training and strength training, fundamentally. So we can talk about exercise and we can talk about all of the different aspects and types of exercise that are important, and they are extremely important. But among, you know, cardiovascular exercise and flexibility or mobility-oriented exercise, to me, strength training is number one. And here's why. There's something in, clinically, the term is sarcopenia. What it means is muscle wasting. So from the time we're about 30 to 35, we start to lose muscle mass, and that loss tends to exponentially increase as we age. And it can be somewhere, the rate of muscle loss can change depending on a number of factors. But if there's one thing I've learned, and that is when you become weak, when muscle tends to go away, there's much more stress on the joints. Osteoarthritis tends to increase. Other factors come into play that increase our level of dysfunction, that make daily activity more difficult. And there's also lots of other factors that are actually physiological in nature, chemical in nature, the secretion of myokines from muscle that's activated, for example.
Right.
Number one is maintaining muscle strength, engaging in a strength training program that allows us to maintain our ability to move and function. You know, despite all the things about aging and longevity that are still somewhat a mystery, there's no mystery about function. It starts with, you know, of course, our ability to move our joints freely through their range of motion. But in many respects, it comes back to muscle strength, number one. I mean, if your listeners could take that one thing, which is to say, okay, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I'm going to start to learn how I can engage in strength training that's effective and efficient. There's a chapter in my book on isometric strength training, which is the simplest and easiest approach. You don't need equipment. You don't need skills. You don't need to go to a gym. You only need about 10 to 15 minutes a day, and you can create a lot of muscle fatigue and really start to create integration and engage muscle. And that's exactly what we need to do. So that's number one. And I would say number two is really a broad recommendation for every single person. And that is to start to focus on eating real food and eliminating or reducing the amount of processed food. Yeah. Now, this sounds simple enough, right? I can tell you, after all of the years of study and experience with regard to nutrition and diet and all of this stuff, I mean, if someone, you know, like, hey, what's your one recommendation? I'd say, eat real food. Again, sounds simple, but the reality is processed industrialized food is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Yeah. constant messages for people to eat frequently, which is not a good idea. And to eat these foods, which are convenient or packaged or last a long time.
And sometimes look like they have a health benefit to them.
That's correct. It's all marketing, and it's all, unfortunately, largely driven by, you know, the profit margin of food manufacturers. You know, their ideas are very clear. What we need to do is create foods that have a great mouthfeel, that are addictive, that look good, that taste fantastic, and just keep people, you know, get people eating these things constantly. And there's so many downstream negative effects from that processed food that we could talk about at length. But the reality is, if we could just take a step back and say, hey, how can I just eliminate one processed food from my diet and replace it with a real food? If I could start to just make that tiny little change, and this is true even for the 25 to 30 year old dad who's listening right now, because those folks, you know, they're usually stressed. I mean, if you're raising a family, you have a spouse and you have a career or a job, and you know, the stress of modern life. So you start small, you start really small. You start with a change that's almost imperceptible. It's so small. You don't try to overhaul your diet, right? You don't sign up for an hour a day at the gym tomorrow when you haven't been in 10 years. Those, you know, they sound admirable enough, but they're recipes really for disaster, because in the end, you're just setting yourself up to be frustrated and end up, you know, being mad at yourself because you couldn't stick with it. Yeah. Tiny changes, replace just one food, you know, and then build on that from there as you start to feel better, as the cravings start to go away, as you start to enjoy the actual tastes of real food. So those two things, I would say, real food versus processed food, tiny changes there. And then the second is just strength training. Start to think about this idea that when muscle goes away, everything else downstream from there gets harder.
So would you say to somebody in that plus 55 cohort who hasn't done, I mean, like I'm talking about myself, who hasn't done strength training in a while? I've done that periodically in my life, but for whatever reason, COVID shut my personal trainer down and then I haven't gotten back into it. And now I'm 65. Have I missed the boat because I didn't start actively doing this at 40? Or would you say, like, I expect you to do it, like, it's never too late, start today and you can still catch up. But there must be some point where it doesn't really matter, right? Or does it?
Well, I absolutely believe it's never too late, because the idea is that you're not going backward, right? I mean, there's a reason why the rearview mirror in your car is really small and the windshield is really large. You can't look back at what could have been, what if, whatever. I mean, if you're 55 and you haven't done strength training before, it pays no mind to worry about what you should have done at 40. What you have to do is make a decision to just try to make the years and the days and the months and the weeks ahead the best that they can be. And your body is amazing in its ability to heal itself if you just stop picking the scab, right? So you start to build some skills and start to learn more, and you can absolutely make remarkable changes. Can you undo the past? Well, I don't know. That's a question I'm not smart enough to answer, but I do believe, I've seen it time and time again. Yeah. I've seen people transform simply because they started to act in their own behalf.
Yeah, but I have heard the ideal time is by the age 40 to have a consistent strength training routine, because otherwise your muscles they don't atrophy, but you lose that muscle mass, like as you say, and it's harder to maintain that.
It gets progressively harder. Right. I mean, I wish I could paint a pretty picture. It's not a pretty picture.
Right.
I will tell you that as I sit here right now at 63, I'm stronger than I've ever been, which is saying a lot considering I've done it for my entire life. But I work extremely hard at it. And I know I'm fighting a difficult battle every day to, you know, hopefully build strength, but just hold on to what I have, you know, absolutely.
And then what do you say to guys who they're active in a certain way? Again, I guess I'm looking at myself as an example. I bike a lot. I do 100 push-ups every other day. I'm fairly active, but I'm not doing that key strength training. I'm just trying to get an idea of what, I mean, because I really hear you, and I've read so much in the past year about it, the importance of the strength training. And maybe they all work together, right? I mean, aerobic exercise, strength training, right diet, right mental attitude, they're all part of the same puzzle.
Yeah. You know, you bring up a number of interesting questions, and I want to try to answer them and address them. You know, the first thing is, You know, and I know that the great majority of your audience is probably sitting there listening right now going, well, I play golf 4 times
right,
a week.
Yeah.
Or, you know, my wife and I go out and walk for an hour, you know, 5 days a week. I don't know what Al's talking about, man. I'm doing it, you know?
Yeah. I don't have time to do more than what I'm doing.
Right. So the reality is, Paul, there's a continuum. And for somebody who never moves, never gets up, getting up and walking for 5 minutes is a big win. For that person, that's where they're at. And that's tremendous that they're making that change. For the person who's playing golf 4 times or 5 times a week or who's walking for an hour a day, I would say that's fantastic. That's great. But it's not enough. It's not enough because as you're playing golf, your muscles are going away. As you're walking, you're not loading your muscles in any specific way to fight the effects of sarcopenia. Are you getting a very low level of cardiovascular exercise? Sure. Is walking good for you? Sure. It's not enough. It is not enough. That's the simple fact of it. It's why I didn't say, to answer your question earlier, walking's number one, because as a general rule, it's not. So I think every single person needs to look at where they're at relative to where they want to be, and then understand that they may still need to make some changes, that you may, if you're walking 4 or 5 days a week, 2 or 3 of those walks, instead of doing an hour, do a half hour and do 20 minutes of isometric strength training instead, right? Or that kind of thing. In other words, you start to exchange the time you're spending here to spend it there. You know, you said earlier that, you know, you do 100 push-ups a couple of days a week. And I want to point out that is absolute, that's absolutely strength training. In fact, I believe that aside from the isometric training that I mentioned earlier, which is far and away the easiest way for people to get started, bodyweight strength training is the ideal approach. And I've got a program on my Pursuit Athletic Performance website that's called the Foundation Bodyweight Strength Training Program. So exercises that are entire body weight oriented, you're learning how to control your body weight, you're improving your balance, you're improving mobility and flexibility as you're moving through these exercises, and their lower body, upper body, it creates integration. It's more functional. I don't like that word, but it's more functional in nature, right? So that to me is much more important than saying, oh, okay, Al said, I got a strength train, so I'm going to go to the gym and try to pick up heavy stuff. Because that is a recipe for injury.
Yeah.
That's a recipe for injury. And that's not what we want. Right. In fact, when I say strength training, I'm not saying go higher a personal trainer who's a former bodybuilder and who says, come over to this barbell and let's see how much weight you can pick up.
Right.
That is a mistake. Don't let that happen, because those are recipes for disaster for one simple reason. We need fundamental movement skills to be in place first before we start to engage in activities which are highly skilled. Again, in my book, which I've already mentioned once, I've got a chapter on how to improve your stability. It's such an incredibly complex topic, but I address it very simply. It's where everybody should begin. It's sort of developmental in nature. It's something we learn as infants and as children. We lose it as we get older. Very basic stability. How to improve that? That's where you should start. And then the isometric training. Again, you don't need a skill. You don't need a gym. You don't need fancy equipment, but you do need to follow some directions, utilize your breath, and do a few of these exercises, and they teach you how to get started.
So I would guess that yoga would be the type of activity that would do a lot of these things at the same time, because there is a strength component there, there's a flexibility component there, there's a stability component there, and there's a mind component there. Does that work, or am I wrong about yoga?
No, I think yoga, you know, we can talk about it in general terms, but the reality is every yoga class is different, and different forms of yoga have different areas of
focus.
But to be fair, listen, yoga is a tremendous practice that brings so many benefits. But I will say, in my 10 years working in clinic in a gait analysis lab, I owned a gait analysis lab with a sports physician. We worked in clinic for about 10 years. That was working with people who were injured or who were recovering from surgery that was orthopedic in nature, or who wanted to avoid injury. These were athletes that wanted to get faster. And one of the things that I learned over those 10 years that were, you know, there were people who went to yoga religiously. And so they had very high levels of flexibility and mobility. That is to say, joint mobility, the ability for joints to move freely. They're very happy in those yoga classes, but they didn't engage their muscles in the ways that they need to. So they were getting weaker as time went on. And they also weren't addressing cardiovascular fitness in any real way. So I think yoga is fantastic, but again, all of these pieces of what I think of as the aging puzzle, we want to make sure we get a balanced approach. So if we're going to pursue yoga, we want all of those aspects that you mentioned to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've touched on a lot of these different elements, and some of them maybe are kind of like obvious. I mean, everybody, like my wife is constantly telling me, strength training. Are there any things that you would say that people don't think of when they think of this, you know, getting set at early on or maybe older age that is maybe a secret that you've discovered along the way that does make difference, like eating tomatoes for, I don't know what it is, some miracle cure. We're looking for a miracle cure out.
Well, you know what? The healthiest food that people are probably not eating on a regular basis is celery. How's that for you? Celery is actually very high in nitrates, which is sort of a building block for nitric oxide, which is extremely important. You think of Viagra. What is Viagra? It's a vasodilator. It's basically introducing more nitric oxide to your body, right, to increase blood flow. So celery and arugula and beets are three foods that are high in nitrates, and they're actually very healthy for you. So there's your magic bullet right there. Listen, you know, Paul, your question made me think of something. I've been working on putting together some ideas for a TEDx talk. And as I was talking and discussing this idea with a friend of mine, I mentioned one portion of the epilogue of my book where I tell the story of having a very difficult conversation with my mom, who at the time was, I think, 81. And her health was failing rapidly. She was in constant pain and she was really suffering. And the truth of the matter is everything I had tried to do to help her to feel better, she simply didn't act on. She just didn't want to hear it.
Right.
And it was very frustrating. And I've learned since then that my family are the hardest people to honestly communicate with. But one of the conversations we had, and I tell this story in the book, is I asked my mom point blank, I said, what would you do differently right now if you knew you were going to live to be 100, but you weren't guaranteed of good health?
Right.
And she scoffed and kind of blew me off. But in reality, as I think back on it, and again, I talk about this in the book, I think it's a profound question. And I think it addresses in part what you're asking me right now. And of course, I'm asking you to think a little bit and sort of reflect on this question, because I don't know how old you are, but if you're around my age, you're 63, in your mid-60s, perhaps even in your mid-50s, whatever it may be, it's my experience that when people get to that age, they kind of fall into two categories. The first category is, you know, life's going to be, you know, when God was ready for me, he'll take me and blah,
right.
You know.
Right, right, right.
And the other category is, man, I got to hurry up and get things done because I'm not going to be around that long.
Yeah.
And so you sort of act, you know, you act in a way where you rush to get in and out of things, knowing that, for example, in your own mind, knowing that you don't have that much more time and you really could be gone at any time, which of course is true. You know, my point in asking that question to her wasn't that we shouldn't live every day to its fullest and never take a day for granted. That wasn't my point at all. My point was, if you're in your mid-60s and you're thinking as though I'm going to be here until I'm 100, in reality, you've got 35 to 40 years to learn a new skill, to get into an exercise program in a smart way, to gradually change your eating, to start to find a new purpose and mission to your life that goes beyond your first or second career.
Yeah.
To, you know, to literally embrace a growth mindset, a mindset where there's time for you to learn and grow. And when we look at blue zones, this is exactly how people think. know, the average Okinawan is involved in their 70s or their 80s in their community and, you know, in pursuing meaningful activities. It could be as simple as helping their neighbor or babysitting grandchildren. It doesn't have to be some big, massive purpose. But the point is, I think what I would suggest to your listeners is to stop and think for a moment. If you're that age, what are you really approaching your life in a way where you can give yourself time to do it the right way? Because we don't want to rush into an exercise program, end up injured, end up having a knee replacement because we did something dumb in an effort to go at it really quickly. You know, take some time to learn skills, learn some basics and fundamentals, really start to understand what you're trying to achieve. And then when you move at it that way, a year from now, you're much better off than you would have been otherwise. And you're looking at life, particularly the second half of your life, in a very different way. So it's a different way to think.
Yeah, I think you said a bunch of things that are important there, is that for somebody who's a little bit younger, thinking about that, not a lot younger, not all the way back down to 25, 35, but if you're in your 50s, start thinking about that transition and how that's going to go. But then also, if you are 65 and you're kind of in the mindset of your parents, which was, you know, life's going to be over here in like 5 years, I'm going to the retirement home and I'm going to lie around and you just wait for the end. You probably should switch that mindset to thinking you may have 30 years. My mom is 93. Her sister's 97. If I took the example of my father who died at 67, I would be looking completely differently at, you know, my savings account and everything else. So there's a lot of inspiration there, I think, in grabbing onto that idea that you've got a lot of time left. And if you've done things right, you're going to live those years with
in the best ways that you can, with a little bit of good fortune and taking personal responsibility for how it's going to flow out. You know, one of the things I said about my dad was, I think like many of his generation, they placed trust in the healthcare system, too much trust in their doctors, too much, you know, trust in, they didn't really understand the environment and the dangers in their environment. So it's really about taking personal responsibility and understanding that if you're going to create a great second half to your life, if it's going to happen and manifest the way you want it to in your mind's eye, your sort of ideal way to go out, that you've got to take an active role in creating that for yourself.
Yeah. That's really important. Well, great. You've got the book you've got is Age Well and Feel Great, The Proven Path to Solving the Age Puzzle. And I love the way you studied all these different disciplines, because we tend to just think of, I'm going to, you know, eat a carrot or I'm going to take this drug, rather than having this overall approach. And doing one thing doesn't give you a pass in all those other dimensions, I think, if you want to really age well. And your whole message is living this last chapter, I shouldn't say last chapter, but living this chapter, which is what we all do, in a way that is good and positive, and then hopefully going off into the sunset at some long distant future in a non-painful, non-horrible way, which we've seen older people do for years.
Yeah, I mean, when we look at dementia right now, for example, Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, the rates of these illnesses are skyrocketing, and it's incredibly sad.
Well, some of it is, though, to be fair, some of it is due that we're living longer, and now the people who would have died at 65 now live to be 75, and then they have dementia at 75. But I take your point. I think we don't know what we don't know about dementia at this point.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, as you can imagine, I engage every single day in learning what science is teaching us every day and what we're learning, you know, on the research side of things. And there's incredible insights now into the metabolic connections between mental illness and dementias. In fact, you know, Alzheimer's is now thought of as, you know, as sort of the mental type 2 diabetes in many respects.
Yeah, so, I've heard all kinds of links to drugs, things that we kind of took for like Ambien, for example. Overuse of Ambien can lead to dementia. There's a whole bunch of other things like the GERD.
Yeah, it goes down a long list. You know, as I sit here in front of you, other than an occasional antibiotic after dental work, I've never taken a prescription drug. Yeah. And I think that certainly makes me a very rare person in this day and age, because I think the average 63-year-old is on four different prescription medications.
Yeah.
And those, all of those prescription meds all have side effects, and those downstream side effects are not good.
Yeah. And we don't know a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And half of them we're not aware of. So it really is, you know, this simple idea that what we really want to do is over some period of time, adapt a lifestyle that honors our health, where we take personal responsibility. And that requires a change in mindset, because it isn't like follow a diet to lose weight. Diets don't work. They never worked. Counting calories has never worked as a long-term solution for nutrition issues or diet issues or weight issues. And by the same token, it isn't like I'm going to exercise for some period of time. And, you know, it's, again, Paul, it's a lifestyle where we're, what I think of is demonstrating self-love, because some level of self-discipline, some level of self-care, those are, in my mind, the sincerest forms of self-love. It's how we advocate for, you know, the way we want to live our lives. As my tattoo says, make him proud. It's the way that I can best live my life to advocate for a certain approach, where I'm trying to share what I learned and trying to make the world a better place, where I know my dad would be proud of me, and my kids are certainly proud of me. And I think that, you know, it all really comes full circle, because in the end, we don't want to become a burden to those, you know, those that, you know, we love the most, that we least want to burden. I mean, there are countless people out there that are my age that are watching, you know, their parents fail, that are dealing with guilt and all kinds of, you know, emotional challenges with how they deal with these situations of declining health and watching somebody die a slow, gradual death. And it's tragic and it's sad. And in many instances, it doesn't have to be that way, but it requires us to act, to believe that we can actually be stronger in our second half.
Right. Well, good. Al, it's really been a pleasure chatting with you about this. I'm inspired to go to the Y and sign up for the strength training and take it to another level. You can find Al at thealliman.com. That's A-L-Y-M-A-N, thealliman.com. And there's a link to the book, as well as the other website that you have, which is
Pursuit Athletic Performance. I've got some online courses there that are really strength training, mobility training, flexibility training, simple follow along online courses that you can sign up for and, you know, have at it in the comfort of your own home. So a lot of resources out there for sure. My whole goal has just been to share what I've learned. I've made all the mistakes, Paul, or most of them. So we should learn from others rather than, right? Which is the challenge of our humanity.
I know. That is really the challenge for young people, is they never want to listen to people who've already been through it. But when you reach this age, even though at the time, you know, when you were younger, you said, you realize how much wisdom and the most efficient way to learn anything is to have people help you through it rather than bumble along like most of us do throughout our lives. Yeah. Well, Al, thanks a lot for joining me today. For those of you interested in my coaching, it's at Paul Banas or greatdad.com/coaching. It's also at paulbanascoaching.com. But until next time, take care.